that oppression is one of those evil traits where the one who commits oppression will witness the evil results for themselves of this oppression even before they die. This is dialogue Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Try to be understanding of the source you're getting the hadith from. If it's an unknown source, then there's a bigger question mark on it. If a random social media post says Amir al-Mu'mineen said this, then there's a bigger question mark on that. If he said it, sam'an wa ta'ata, we accept it, it's heard, it's we submit to it, and so on and so forth. But did he say it? There's no reference there, like, there's a big question mark, I can't accept this. If some speaker said this, what's their background? Do they have an authority to know hadith and present it? If they don't, again, a big question mark. If the person has got a background that we see the scholarship, the track record, he's careful, he has the access to these books, a little less of a question mark, but still a question mark until we can verify it, but the person we're getting it from, the people we're getting it from, that part of them is a little easier. And just because somebody uses some big words or throws out names of books doesn't mean that it's accurate. In this book it says that, in that book it says that. Some naive people are like, well, he must know what he's talking about. Well, there was a research by a so-called professor, Robert Gleave, in the UK, Exeter University. He's got some works. He's an expert on akhbarism. The mal'oon, who the British akhbarism growing in the subcontinent is because of this mal'oon's research. Anyhow, so he's got works on akhbaris and usulis at a very critical time, a type of work that unfortunately many Hausa students today, they haven't done their own homework. They look at the work of Robert Gleave, footnotes, reference number 1, 2, 3, 10 references. There's only that much text. The rest of it is footnotes with reference. They're like, oh my God, you know, he must know what he's talking about. Like, brother, you're a Hausa student.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
in the limelight. Researchers say coronavirus is more contagious and more lethal than influenza, and we lack the same global protection mechanism. We have prepared for you an article written by Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Why Living with COVID Would Not Be the Same as Flu. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. England prepares to ease coronavirus restrictions further, the messaging from ministers has changed. They said, it seems we have reached a tipping point in the pandemic where rules will be replaced by personal decisions. The mantra now is about living with coronavirus, much as we do with seasonal flu. The pandemic has invited countless comparisons between coronavirus and influenza, and the diseases do have some features in common. Both are contagious, potentially lethal respiratory viruses. They can spread through aerosols, droplets, and contaminated surfaces. And they share some of the same symptoms in the form of fever, cough, headaches, and fatigue. In the winter ahead, one challenge the NHS staff face is separating the COVID patients from the flu cases. But there are striking differences between coronavirus and flu as well, and these matter very much for public health. Coronavirus spreads faster than influenza and can cause far more serious illness. The symptoms of coronavirus can take longer to show, and people tend to be contagious for longer, making them more prone to passing it on. Seasonal influenza has been around long enough that previous infection and protection from vaccines bear down on cases and deaths. Analysis of previous influenza outbreaks suggests that there are value for seasonal flu. The number of people an infected person passes the virus onto averages about 1.28. This means a group of four people with flu might pass the virus onto five more people. Coronavirus spreads more easily than that. For the Delta variant now surging around the world, R is estimated at about 7. So in the absence of vaccines and other interventions, a single case would infect an average of 7 others. As vaccination programs push on and the virus continues to spread, immunity to coronavirus will drive R down. But how low is a moot point. Coronavirus is more lethal than influenza, largely because vulnerability to the disease rockets in older people. Seasonal influenza killed an estimated 44,505 people in England during the three combined flu seasons from 2015-2016 to 2018-2019. That number died from COVID in England in the first 9 weeks of 2021. A major difference is that the flu figure takes into account the protection of influenza vaccines, where 50% effectiveness is considered good. Coronavirus vaccines should have a greater proportional impact on COVID deaths. So far, the most common COVID vaccines used in the United Kingdom, the Oxford AstraZeneca and the Pfizer-BioNTech shots, reduce the risk of hospitalization from COVID by more than 90%. As a result, the vaccination program has driven COVID deaths down substantially to fewer than 20 a day in the past week. But the vaccines do much more to prevent death than transmission of the virus, so cases of COVID are expected to rise for some time yet. The larger the epidemic grows, the more chance the virus has of finding vulnerable people who have not had their vaccine shots or are not sufficiently protected by the vaccine. While the vaccines dramatically weaken the link between cases and deaths, they are unlikely to break it entirely. The differences between coronavirus, influenza, and the vaccines that target them can easily eclipse a more fundamental issue, though. Learning to live with coronavirus as we live with flu does not mean society can take it in its stride. Every year, a comprehensive global surveillance network detects which variants of influenza are in circulation and most likely to pose a threat in the following season. That information determines which strains go into the annual flu vaccines that are then rolled out in established campaigns. Throughout the flu season, the public health authorities issue case counts and, if needed, update their advice on medical care. There is no such global system for coronavirus as yet. And despite the well-oiled machine that protects the world from flu, the death toll from the virus in a typical year is still substantial. Every winter, flu puts enormous stress on the National Health Service, the NHS, at times pushing it to breaking point. For the health service, living with coronavirus means learning to endure a double wave each winter as coronavirus and flu arrive together. Researchers are working to establish whether the flu jab and a COVID vaccine can be given at the same time as the NHS braces itself for a potential surge in cases of flu this winter. Experts say giving the two shots at the same time could save precious resources for the NHS by avoiding millions of unnecessary appointments. Adam Finn, professor of pediatrics at Bristol Medical School and a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization, said, "It isn't actually that difficult to give two injections at the same time. We do this in children all the time. But organizing totally different visits has a massive implication in terms of resources and time and so on." According to surveillance data largely encompassing England compiled by the Royal College of GPs, since the start of the pandemic, lockdowns, social distancing and mask wearing have reduced the risk of contracting not only COVID, but other respiratory bugs as well, such as the flu, cases of which were basically non-existent last winter. Assuming that many of these measures are lifted in the coming months, a resurgence of flu viruses is expected. Graham Medley, a professor at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who chairs the SAGE subgroup on pandemic modelling, said, "I think we absolutely expect that contact rates will not be as low this coming winter as they were last winter. Restrictions will not be as heavy, and as a result, there will be a flu epidemic." Graham Medley said, "And because of the fact we didn't have one last winter, that might be a bit larger, or a lot larger, and I think that's something that focus will turn to as much as COVID in the future." The ComFluCov study is looking at what side effects people get when they are given a recommended flu vaccine alongside either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer BioNTech jab, as well as the immune responses when the two shots are co-administered. Professor Finn said early results on the side effects when the two jabs are given together had been shared with the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. The study's chief investigator, Dr. Rayeka Lazarus, a consultant in infectious diseases and microbiology at University Hospitals Bristol and Western NHS Foundation Trust, said, "However, the official results are expected by August or September." She said, "For now, the study is looking at the impact of giving the second COVID dose alongside a flu vaccine, but further research may be needed if a subsequent booster COVID shot is required." Professor Finn said there was a reasonably strong possibility that both the COVID and flu jabs could be administered in one appointment, either this autumn or as part of a program to administer COVID booster shots early next year, or even both. The big question facing researchers on the Come-Flu-Cough study is whether the side effects produced by giving both jabs together are worse than when they are given on their own. Another key question is whether the immunity provided by the two jabs changes when they are administered at the same time. Martin Hibbard, a professor of emerging infectious diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said one concern is that the immune system could respond to one vaccine more than the other, adding, "So you might get a very good response to the COVID vaccine, let's say, but not a very good one to the flu jab, or the other way around. And so that could be a problem." He added, alternatively, getting the jabs at the same time might boost the immune response to both. Novavax, the COVID vaccine developer that recently published successful late-stage data on its jab, examined a study that has yet to be peer-reviewed, whether its vaccine could be given in tandem with an influenza vaccine. Data showed that co-administered the jabs resulted in no change to influenza vaccine immune response, while a minor reduction in antibody responses from 89.8% to 87.5% was found for the COVID vaccine. Novavax and Moderna are also in the early stages of developing a combined COVID and flu vaccine.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام ما المبتلى الذي قد اشتد به البلاء بأحوج إلى الدعاء الذي لا يأمن البلاء.
Thank you.
Imam Ali said, "The person who is afflicted with hardship is not in greater need of praying than the one who has been spared affliction but is not immune from it." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, is the fact that we should try to make children happy, and we should do all that we can to help the poor. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam received word that there was a widowed woman who had some small children and they were poor and disenfranchised. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, along with his servant Qambar, go to the house of this woman and they take with them dates and oil and bread. Interestingly, Imam Ali carried these things himself, and he did not allow Qambar, his servant, to pick these things up. When they reached the house of the widowed woman, Imam Ali alayhi salam asks her permission to enter the house. The woman allows Imam Ali and Qambar to enter, and the door was opened. Imam Ali personally himself undertook to prepare the food for this family. Now keep in mind, he is the caliph of the Muslims. He is the topmost supreme position in the Islamic government and among all the Islamic lands. Imam Ali puts some water, some rice, and some oil in a pot and waits for the food to be cooked. When the food was ready, he calls the children to come and eat the food. The children were happily engaged in eating the food which Imam Ali had just cooked for them. And in order to make them happy and amuse these children after eating, Imam Ali started to play with them, and he was imitating the bleating of a lamb, which made these children laugh. Qambar, who was witnessing this scene, says, "Oh my master, I saw a strange thing from you, which was that you were imitating the bleating of lambs." Carrying the food was certainly aimed at winning Allah's pleasure, at gaining nearness to Allah, and to gain a reward in the hereafter. But what was this bleating about? Imam Ali says, "When we entered the old woman's house, her children were crying from hunger. So I intended to make them happy in addition to feeding them. I found no better way than that, bleating like a lamb, to make these children happy." And so, dear friends, we learn here from the universal persona of Imam Ali that we should keep our children happy. We should keep children in general happy. They are innocent, they are young, and they need happiness in their lives. And of course, the other point, that we should help the poor and the disenfranchised to whatever extent we can in order to gain the pleasure, the satisfaction, and the nearness of Allah. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Thank you.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
أسعد حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program To My Brother, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in chapter 4, verse 135, Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu kunu qawwamina bilqist. شهداء لله ولو على أنفسكم أو الوالدين والأقربين إن يكن غنيا أو فقيرا فالله أولى بهما. And in reality, the Imam عليه الصلاة والسلام in his letter toward Malik al-Ashtar quotes this particular verse of the Quran, in which he tells Malik that, O Malik, when you go out into the world, know that you have a responsibility to uphold justice. You have certain standards, you have certain values. You have to make your very best effort because within yourself you have potential to make difference in the world that you're living in. But make sure that when you're making that difference, make sure that you're doing it for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's really, really easy to take a position, to do something, to go and attend a protest, to go and write something on social media, or even to go and write an op-ed or an article in your local newspaper. But if you're doing it so that people come and they like and they retweet your post, or because you want people to tell you about how great of a writer, how great of a speaker you are, then at the end of the day, we're not doing it for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he then tells Malik al-Ashtar, he says, O Malik, and if you want people to be generous to you, then be generous to the people. And if you want people to be kind to you, then be kind to the people. And if you want people to be favorable to you, then be favorable to the people. And then toward the end of that famous letter, he states, and O Malik, know that people are of two types, either your brothers in faith or your equals in humanity. Imam Ali in this letter toward Malik al-Ashtar in reality gives a brief insight in terms of how we should live with people in society and community at every stage within our lives. Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, as we know by that famous Christian writer, is called the Sawt al-Adalat al-Insaniya, the voice of human justice, a man who would stand up even for his own enemies. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, as we know, what makes him so unique is that on that same day of Ashura, after every single one of his family members had been killed, and he reaches the river Euphrates, and he is about to take water, the Imam was incredibly thirsty. Yet he looks at his horse and says, Oh horse, you take water before me. That same Hussein alayhi salam, who is standing behind the tent on the day of Ashura, as some narrators they report, that when some of the family members, they came towards Sayyid al-Shuhada, and they said, Ya ibn Rasulullah, We see you behind the tent. It's the middle of the battlefield and you're crying right now. Why? And he says, because I'm afraid that those on the opposing army, they're going to enter into hell because they want to shed my blood. This is Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, making an effort to change the world because they care about people.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, silence and talking less. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Man's power is not unlimited and everlasting. Therefore, when his energies are used in one direction, there will be less energy left for other things. So it is not surprising if most talkative people are short on actions and experiences. because they're spending all their time, their energies, their focus on talking. So when are you going to act? Unfortunately, there's a misbalance that we see in speakers when it comes to their actions, right? They say all those big things, and then when it comes to acting, they have pretty much nothing to offer or way less than what they keep saying verbally. The Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, always advocated positive and effective living. He says that believers are those who emphasize deeds, not just words. While he considers the opposite attribute of all talk and no action as the sign of hypocrites. So those who are believers, they not only talk, they act on what they preach. While the hypocrites are those who keep talking about these profound concepts of Islam, giving advices to other, giving admonitions to other, but when it comes to their personal actions and lives, they are hollow. These are the ones who, according to Islam and the teachings of Islam and many traditions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, are qualified to be hypocrites. Their actions are not in line with their sayings. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing silence and talking less. And we said those who talk a lot, generally speaking, their actions are small. Their actions are insignificant. They don't really match up with what they have to say. And then there are those who keep talking about positive things, but when it comes to their private lives and their personal lives, you see that their actions do not match up with what they have to say. Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, when you find a believer silent, approach him, because you will hear wise things. Believers talk less and are action-oriented, whereas hypocrites are talkative and inexperienced. See again how profound this whole idea is. Talking in excess is discouraged in Islam. There is a saying that silence is gold. In Islam, talking less is something important, as it is stressed in the Holy Quran. Talking less allows one to not only rethink about what one wants to say, but restrains oneself from speaking what is unnecessary. It's not a secret that now in the modern world, people talk too much, and it sometimes causes disunity and discord among the society, especially when it comes to careless talking. You know, if you want to look at the examples of careless talking, look at the speakers who fanned the flame of sectarianism. You know, sectarian sentiment is being pushed, especially when you look at the Islamic world. Why is it that? Because people like to talk. They want to talk, and they want to talk in excess. Look at, you know, how sometimes secrets are revealed. Because somebody is talkative, they can't keep the secrets in their hearts, secrets of other believers. And we know that Islam does not allow us to share the secrets of other believers. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam.
Since 1941, Americans have annually celebrated Independence Day on the 4th of July, a celebration that goes back to the 18th century, when American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. The Declaration of Independence declared that all men are created equal, endowed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it seems these laws did not apply to Native Americans as well as African Americans. This 4th of July, the United States is grappled with a global pandemic. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the coronavirus pandemic in terms of infections and fatalities. Also, the U.S. is experiencing an intense period of political and social unrest. On January 6th, a mob of then-President Donald Trump supporters stormed the Capitol while Congress was holding sessions to officially certify President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 race. The attack left 5 people dead, including a Capitol police officer. Trump's critics said his incendiary remarks during his speech on the same day encouraged his supporters to storm Congress. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. Experts say the dramatic gap in police shootings and prison rates reflects biased policing, as well as the vast economic and educational inequalities that plague much of the country.
Because the United States has never, ever really come to grips with the racist foundations of the country, and it has never come to grips with the racist elements within the country that continue to this day.
This 4th of July, a new Yahoo News and YouGov poll showed that a majority of Americans believe everything about the United States is on the wane. 62% of Americans who responded to the survey said the U.S. is no longer the shining city on a hill. They feel the country is getting worse and are deeply divided over how to handle the coronavirus and protests sparked by the death of George Floyd. 49% of Americans said the U.S. response to the COVID-19 pandemic was worse than expected. Yet America's gloomy outlook goes beyond the pandemic. 64% of Americans say race relations, the focus of mass protests since George Floyd was killed by a Minneapolis police officer in late May, are also getting worse. Floyd's death sparked protests across the U.S. and globe that are a reminder of the oppression that people of color in the U.S. have always faced.
So, this whole idea of America being this shining city on the hill, that's mythology. And so what we should do is leave mythology to the Greeks. And we should try now to deal in reality. And the reality is that the United States sees itself as a unitary global hegemon, but what has now become a multipolar world. And Americans refuse to understand that reality. We are no longer the sole bully on the block. There are now other countries that are resisting America's sanctions regime, that can stand up to America's military might.
The once shining city on the hill was built upon the blood and sweat of Native American people and African slaves. 4th of July marks the dawn of a colonial system that came to existence by shedding the blood of millions of Native Americans and enslaving millions of Africans. The United States envoy to the U.S.-led anti-Daesh coalition has warned of a possible resurgence of the Takfiri terrorists in Iraq and Syria due to worsening poverty and inequity there. But what is the root cause of the instability and poverty afflicting Baghdad and Damascus? 2 years after the 9/11 incident, the U.S. invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took lives of over 1 million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos resulted from the U.S. invasion eventually gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. 3 years after, the Takfiri group captured nearly one-third of Iraq's territory. However, Baghdad finally declared victory over the terrorists in December 2017. The victory was owed to the bravery of commanders Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists. However, in a criminal and terrorist act, the U.S. killed these two figures in January 2020. That blatantly contradicts Washington's concern about the resurgence of Daesh. Following the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, anti-U.S. sentiments escalated in Iraq. U.S. bases in the country have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011. That later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The U.S. has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. While the U.S. claims it cares about Syrian civilians, it has imposed crippling economic sanctions on Syria that prevent the country from rebuilding after a decade of war.
It's really hard to be really clear about what's the motivation here, because it could just be stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity in U.S. foreign policy, pigheadedness. The CIA, when people say, why do you keep invading and destroying countries when it doesn't work, when it doesn't help you? And the answer that the CIA gives is, it's what we do. It's what we do. It's just that's the way we function. It's almost like it's an instinct to invade, to create chaos. So that's one possibility. Another one that's related to this is, could just be sour grapes. It could be spoil sport, that the U.S. sees that these countries want to become independent, want to develop independently of the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple the government of President Bashar Assad. After failing to do so through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government implemented additional sanctions in Syria through a law known as the CSAR Act. The crippling sanctions under the CSAR Act specifically target energy and construction sectors to prevent Syria from rebuilding. After a decade of war, the CSAR Act enabled Washington to sanction any person involved in reconstruction efforts in government-controlled parts of Syria. The correlation between U.S. economic sanctions and the crisis in Syria is clear. Syria's currency has plummeted and prices for basic goods have soared as a result of the sanctions. According to the UN, 60% of Syrians lack access to sufficient food. Besides the economic embargo, the U.S. has also occupied oil fields in Syria's northeast, depriving Damascus of a vital resource. Moreover, the UN has warned that U.S. sanctions have hampered humanitarian aid deliveries in Syria.
Yes, they do want a certain amount of instability and chaos wherever their own interests are threatened. So Syria, it was clearly the strongest anti-imperialist, anti-American force, anti-Israel force in the Middle East.
Washington alerts that Daesh terrorists might start regaining territory in Iraq and Syria as a result of poverty and instability there. That's while the U.S. has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socioeconomic conditions there. Besides sanctions, U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh never would have formed.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'arib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes on residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarullah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarullah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'arib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They are pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces are closing in on Ma'arib, the last stronghold of pro-Hadi forces in northern Yemen. The loss of the strategic region would mean the defeat of the Saudi-backed regime. Yemeni forces had earlier liberated several strategic heights in the northwest of the province after intense fighting. Analysts believe control of the oil-rich region of Ma'arib would strengthen the bargaining position of Yemeni forces and peace talks. The fierce clashes come amid fresh attempts to bring an end to what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is desperate to find a face-saving way out of its disastrous bombing campaign in Yemen. It is believed that the Saudi regime has failed miserably in Yemen, as its foreign interventions have failed to produce desirable results for the kingdom.
Clearly, it shows that Saudi Arabia could not prevail through military measures. So now they are talking about, let's have a peace agreement. But they're asking for many things that they could not win on the battlefield. So whether they will gain it in peace talks, that's highly unlikely.
The new administration in Washington has pushed for fresh attempts to bring the war to an end. But Yemeni forces have dismissed the so-called peace initiatives presented by the U.S. to end the war in the country, saying such plans are not favorable since they fail to include the Yemeni nation's demands, including lifting the siege on the port city of Aden.
The UN is acting in favor of major powers and exhibits clear bias. The aggressor countries are committing the most heinous crimes against Yemeni children, and yet they were not included in the list. The UN decision is disconnected from realities and does not rely on independent accounts.
Any peace agreement must be based on ending the siege, the closing of the ports, and the distribution of food to the population of Yemen, who've been held hostage by Saudi Arabia and also by the U.S. through this whole process.
Ansarullah movement says no just solution to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been worked out yet. The Yemenis say the aggressors have to end all their attacks against Yemen, take out all their forces, end an all-out siege that they have been imposing on the Arab country, including the port city of Aden, and compensate the victims before entering any peace process.
Well, they certainly have no desirable result. They first announced that this would be a war over in a matter of weeks and then months, and it has dragged on for more than 6 years. So it's a complete disaster in the eyes of the entire region. It does show the weakness of this corrupt regime that is unable to carry on a war against a country far less technologically, doesn't have the means, doesn't have the military forces, and yet it has a mobilization of the people. And that is what is decisive again and again, as we're finding in every country.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies have been engaged in a devastating war in the country that began in March 2015. They were backed by the U.S. and other Western powers. The aggressors were trying to reinstall Yemen's former president, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, a staunch ally of Riyadh, to crush the Ansarullah movement. The Saudi war has failed to achieve its goals, but pushed Yemen to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Saudi officials claimed that the war would last only a few weeks.
The last German soldiers to withdraw from Afghanistan. Over the last couple of years, Germany had the second largest contingent of troops after the United States. The German defense minister says that after nearly 20 years of deployment, the last soldiers left Afghanistan. Annegret Kramp-Karren Bauer added that this is the end of a historic chapter of an intensive mission. 59 German soldiers died in Afghanistan. 35 of them had been killed in combat or as a result of militant attack, making it Germany's deadliest military mission since World War II. Looking back, the minister vowed to discuss where it went wrong and what Berlin has learned.
We've not only accomplished nothing, we have grievously damaged Afghan society over the last 20 years of bombing and so on and so forth. There was never a political coalition in Afghanistan to support the United States, even less so than in Vietnam, in my opinion.
Because of the security problems in Afghanistan and the increasing levels of violence, the German military kept the details of its withdrawal vague. Berlin sent its forces in the wake of the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001. Meanwhile, British media reports suggest the majority of British troops have quietly withdrawn from Afghanistan. Again, Britain withdrawing its forces, if confirmed, would have been shrouded in secrecy. According to the latest UN report, US-led forces, in particular Germany and Italy and the UK, are leaving Afghanistan while the country remains in bad shape. Violence is on the rise and Afghans are facing multiple crises, including rising poverty, which could increase from 50% to 70%. These all suggest that over two decades of foreign military presence has failed to bring peace to Afghanistan. In mid-April, US President Joe Biden and NATO announced they would pull out the roughly 10,000 foreign troops still in Afghanistan at the time by September 11, marking the 20th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York that sparked the invasion of the country itself. The mission had been aimed at toppling the then-ruling Taliban government. 20 years later, Washington has been negotiating with the militant group itself on the best way to withdraw. During those 20 years, Afghans have witnessed a spiral of violence and terror.
It's obvious that this 20 years here hasn't benefited the Afghans in any way. Here we are with 2,500 troops left, more or less, who knows, thousands of contractors, and several different things have come out in the newspaper in the last week. One, in spite of all this alleged training and so on and so forth, the only thing that is flyable in Afghanistan right now in the